Yeah, well, we actually make we're studying. We did the first mishnah. There's a lot more to say, but you know, it's just in the interest of getting things done. All right, so this is mishnah number two. Okay, Shimon HaTzadik Hayam Mishari Knesset HaGdola. Shimon HaTzadik was one of the last of the Atzei Knesset HaGdola. We'll see in a minute what that means. Hu Haya Omer. Hu Haya Omer means he used to walk around like that. He wasn't. I mean, that wasn't the only thing he had to say, but it means that this was his. It's like his motto. This was his, like, you know, he was this was his sort of like his life's outlook, writ large. His signature statement, correct. Correct. It's like, you know, Red Skelton, you stand by saying, and God bless. Mm-hmm. So the same. So this is what Shimon HaTzadik used to say. Hu Haya Omer, al shlosh dvarim ha'olam omed, there were three, the world stands on three things, ala Torah, ala Avodah, ala Gvilas Chasadim, and Torah, on divine service, which in this case means the Beis HaMikdash, the Korbanos, the sacrifices, and Gvilas Chasadim. The first question has to be asked is obviously the mission at the end of the Perek, which I'm not going to deal with right now, but at least I'll mention it. Is the question, what's the difference? Here he says, al shlosh dvarim ha'olam omed, ala Torah, ala Avodah, ala Gvilas Chasadim. And the last Mishnah said, quotes from Shimon Gamliel, al shlosh dvarim ha'olam omed, the world stands on three things, ala din, vala emes, vala shalom, shenema emes, v'shat mispat shalom, chiftu v'sharecha.
The last Mishnah in
the first parak. So you have the Mishnah over here says olam kayam, olam omed, rather, and the other one says kayam. So the question is, what's the relationship? So yeah, okay, you can have all kinds of different variations on this. One will say that they really say the same thing. Ebiz Din Shalom is the same as Torah Avodah Migil Chasadim. Others say no. What is the difference between Kayam and Omeid? You have an interesting, you know, I'll give an example. Interesting example of how that could actually work. There's a fast, you know, there's the Bible critics make a very, very big deal about the fact that there were two stories of creation in the beginning of Bereshis. So the one of the things that they quote is the fact that the first Perek. The first parak uses the word Elohim, and the second parak is Yudke Vavke. And it says something incredible, which is related to the way you could actually resolve these two Mishnayos. The Netziv says as follows. He says, look, Bereshis Bara Elohim. Elohim means, Elohim is a judge. Okay? Adha Elohim, that's what it's called. Elohim is word for judge. It stands for law. That's one of the things that that the Rav used to point out that in the story of Matan Torah, you have the whole lead up, most of the lead up to the Aseret Dibros is Yudke Vavke, which indicates God who transcends nature, and Elohim is much more universal and much more harsh, more of a judge. And it's also up until the actual Seres Dibros, everything is Yudke Vavke, the source of all being, Yudke Vavke Hayahu Vaviyah. And then you start that, when you come to the Ten Commandments, it says Vayidber Elohim. You shift immediately to Elohim. So why is that? So Rashi says, because I'm a Dayan Liparea. In other words, I'm saying this as a judge who's going to exact punishment. So the Rav points out that obviously that when it comes to more that we're talking about moral law, so therefore it's God the lawgiver, God the judge. So then Tziv works in a similar way. He says the first parak is talking about they're talking about two different things. The first parak talks about creation from a natural point of view. It's a creation of natural law. So of course it's Bereshis Bara Elohim. Because the first parak talks about how the world runs physically. The second parak, which is not a full story about the creation of the world, it goes back to certain aspects of the creation of man and so on, is Yudke Vavke. That's not a matter of how God runs the world. That's how the world runs physically. That's how God guides the world. That's how providence works. Yudke Vavke is made a sarachim. So the world may function according to objective physical laws, but in terms of the way that God guides the world, He runs through rachamim. He runs through mercy. So similarly, that's how you could actually how olam omed al Torah v'al avodah v'al gevurah chasadim. What establishes society could very well be emezim v'shalom. We'll see. But in other words, that's a kind there. In other words, the two words kayam means sustains. Sustains itself, whereas In other cases, it's different, right? Okay. In any event, of course, there is one gears that says kayam, but all right, believe that.
Kayam.
Yeah.
I have kayam.
Yeah. And anyways, yeah, but these Mishnahs have. All right, we'll go into that when we get to that time. We get to that Mishnah. Who is Shimon HaTzadik? Shimon HaTzadik is a whole to do also. There on the one hand, all the Mephoreshim say he was a, and it this has to do, by the way, with the question of when did the period of Akashic and Aslak Dola end? I mentioned that this whole Persian period and the early part of the Greek period, we really know nothing. I mean, lived next to nothing. From the time that at the end of the career of Ezra and Nehemiah until the end of the Ptolemaic period and the beginning of the period of the Seleucid Greeks, we have practically no knowledge of what was going on in Israel, what was going on in Torah, very, very little. So the question is, we don't even know what does this mean at the end of Anshik Nesek Dola. So according to some, if you look in the Babi Bart Nur, for example, says, everybody says that. So what does that mean? That he was a Kohen Gadol after Ezra. Now Ezra died sometime towards the end of the 5th century BC. So in other words, 100 years after, come plus minus, 100 years after the rededication of the Second Temple. Others think there is another Shimon who is well known from a book called Ecclesiasticus. Written by a man named Shimon ben Sira. A book that's very similar to Kohelet. That's why it's called Ecclesiasticus as opposed to Ecclesiastes. And he lived approximately the year 200, plus minus. That was a book that actually led to the discovery of the Cairo Geniza. Because what happened was, this is a book that was very famous. It did not survive in its Hebrew form. It only survived in Greek. We only knew it from the New Testament because it had been preserved by the Church of all things. Although Chazal held the book in very, very high regard to the degree to the point where they quote, where the Gemara quotes him, quotes that book Dichtiv, which is a technical term for quoting Psukim. So does that mean that there were actually days among Chazal that maybe it was part of Kisvei HaKodesh or not? It's a whole discussion. But in any case, in Ben Sira, actually, I should have Xeroxed it and brought it. There's a whole description of Shimon Kohen Gadol, who was this wonderful person, and he was a tremendous leader, and a tremendously spiritual person, and so on and so forth. And there were those who say that's Shimon HaTzadik. In other words, so the Shimon HaTzadik we're dealing with here actually is Shimon HaTzadik who lived at the end of the Ptolemaic period. Eretz Yisrael was conquered from the Persians by Alexander the Great in 322, and then it was conquered by the so then and after when he I'm sorry, it was conquered in 330 something. Alexander the Great died in 322, and his empire was divided into three parts. One part, the Greek part proper, went to one person, and the rest of the empire was divided in half. Egypt, Eretz Israel, Syria was given to Ptolemy, one of his generals, and the rest, all the east, Babylonia, Afghanistan, India, all some stuff, Persia, whatever, all that, Iraq, all that, Turkey, all that was given to Seleucus, who ruled from the city of Antioch. In 190, and they were back and forth between the two of them, they didn't get along. These generals were called the Diadochs, the Diadoch. In any event, in 198, the Antiochus III conquers Eretz Israel from the Ptolemies, and his son is Antiochus IV, who we know from the Chanukah story. Okay. This Shimon HaTzadik lives in this. This Shimon HaTzadik, which is in Ben Sira, lives at this time of a shift. So then the question becomes: there's a big nafkamina. The question is: How long did the Anshei Kesed Gedola? How long did they hold sway? If it was a matter, if they held sway, if they basically existed up until the generation after Ezra, which is the way that the Rabbi Bart Nur seems to indicate, then.
And do we know his sources, or he just says it?
He was an eyewitness. He lived.
No.
Who the Bart Nur? That's a Masoret like that. The Malbim says that also. No, because he says Anshik. Oh, I know why. Because according to according to, or he was in the Jenny generation. Afterwards, there's this famous story that the Samaritan, when Alexander conquered Eretz Israel, the Samaritans came, and the Samaritans came and they wanted to destroy the base of Mikdash, and Alexander was gonna destroy Yerushalayim, and instead and he came to Yerushalayim came to Yerushalayim, and at that point the Shimon HaTzadik was a Kohen Gadol. He came out with a whole retinue, and he came out to meet Alexander to try to save the city. Alexander got off the horse, and he bowed down to him. He said, "Why they do that? So I had a dream that this person came, and now I realize the dream was true. So therefore, he spared the city." The entire story is, in fact, recounted at the Gemara Yuma. It's engraved on the wall of the putative kever of Shimon HaTzadik in Shimon HaTzadik, down near Sheikh Jarrah, which is actually, I have to admit, is a place that I used to spend a lot of time. When I wanted to run away from someplace, for my own personal Zibaydu, I don't go there anymore, so that's why it's no big secret to say this anymore. For my own personal Zibaydu, that's where I used to go. First of all, there was no reception of cell phone there. It's in a cave. I mean, it's in a Second Temple era cave. And it was this cave. You go in, and this is traditionally the grave of Shimon HaTzadik. Next to it, there are Second Temple era cemetery. They called the graves of Sanhedrin HaKatana, supposed to the Sanhedrin HaGdola in Sanhedrin. And all there was an Aron Kodesh and some chairs and Sfarim, and you could just like
not anymore.
And what?
Not anymore.
Its simplicity, its beauty was in its simplicity. You've been there recently?
A year or two ago.
Okay, I mean, I haven't been there ever since they turned it. Well, it was more than that. What happened was, and first of all, the breast lovers came in. All right, it's fine then there. But somebody went in, and they just, sometimes it's the proof of L'kola Mosif Gorea. First of all, what they had was the women would sit on one side, and they'd sit on. It was simple. There was the beauty of it. Now what they did was they covered it all with marble, and they threw the women out. They won't. The women can't be in there, they patched everything, and they put in chandeliers, and it's so gross. It broke my heart to go there. I mean, just I can't go there anymore. It's like what they did at Kever Rachel. What are you talking about? Kever Rachel also. Or the Rambam's Kever. I mean, all these places, their simplicity were their beauty, and they just made them into, I don't know. Anyway. The Fumim call it Garisa Mosif Gorea. Anyways, in any event, so the question of the dating of Shimon HaTzadik will decide as to whether, when does Anshei Dola end? Does it end at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah? And it was this Shimon HaTzadik was the one who met Alexander, who would have to be a few generations afterwards, because Alexander, comes about 70 years after Ezra, or it's really later. So the question is, how do you square the story? Look, I personally don't have a problem with it. I don't have a problem with it because it could be two Shimon HaTzadiks. The same names appear throughout the
the general understanding of Shimon HaTzadik, the Kever?
It's a traditional attribution. It is certainly a Second Temple era. You see a Second Temple. It has a place to put in bodies. The bodies disintegrate. Then they collect the bones. It's the usual deal. Anyways, or there's another way to say it. It could be two Shimon HaTzadiks, or it could be that the person who met Alexander could have been the great grandfather of this one, or it could be another possibility. And I don't understand why this is not raised as general a possibility. It's not unusual to call significant people by the names of some more famous kings. So, for example, I'll give you an example. There's a famous tradition that is cited both by Reb Elazar of Worms in the 13th century, and it pops up again also another version in the Tshuvas of the Marshal. How did the most significant family in Ashkenaz come to Ashkenaz? They came from Italy. That's in northern Italy. So the story is that the Klonimus family, this famous Ashkenazi family, one of the two founding families of the Ashkenazi Jewry, one is the family of Rabbi Abun, which was the family that gave us Rabbeinu Gershom, and then the Klonimus, they all intermarried anyways after a while, came in around 917 from Lucca, which is north of which is Tuscany. He was brought by King Charles. There was no King Charles in that part of the 10th century. There was Otto, there was Conrad, there was Henry, there were all a bunch of, but there were no emperors named Charles. What's the deal? The deal is that that became like a generic. Every major king was called Charlemagne. And in fact, it's interesting, I don't have evidence to prove it, but I've suspected, in fact, that there's more to it than that, because at that point, legitimate, the early stages of the Holy Roman Empire, was it determined by having Carolingian blood, yet marry a princess, or whatever the case might be. I think they probably called themselves Charlemagne. There is this sort of element of recognition of that. And I wouldn't be surprised if this, so the Gemara calls him Alexander the Great.
Like Caesar.
Yeah, exactly. So they called him Alexander the Great. Okay, very nice. I mean, it doesn't have to be actually Alexander, because of Mr. Knowledge, Alexander wasn't here.
Does it have to be a true story?
It could very well be a true story. I'm willing to give maximum leeway. It's nice of me. I'm much less skeptical about oral historical traditions of Chazal, but you have to realize how they're presented and what coin they're formulated. It's like Hechi Tim says in the Gemara. It is inevitable. My experience has been over all these years that the most bizarre possibilities the Gemara will present will end up turning out to be true or happening. All right. So I'll give you an example. I always quote this example, but it's my story. Before my oldest was born, so my wife and I learned all the sugyas about called mitzvos ha'aval habein in the Gemara in the Mishnah and Kiddushin, Mila and Pidyon HaBen. So there, the Gemara has a discussion. What happens if you only have five shkalim or five slayim, whatever it is, and you have to decide whether you're going to be poti yourself or you're poti your son? So we both said, come on, when you have a situation where you have to decide, who gives this pidyon HaBen first, or where the father has had a pidyon HaBen first and the son. So it turns out, very nice. So what happened was, I knew that I was a firstborn son, but I was born as a cesarean. But my parents didn't know any better. A cesarean. I was born a cesarean section. So at the time, I knew that they had a pidyon HaBen because my parents didn't know any better. But I always say I don't need a pidyon HaBen. So what do women do? So when they talk about their labors. So when after my oldest was born. So my mother's comparing notes with Toby about how your labor going, whatever. So my mother mentions in passing, totally in passing, saying that I actually crowned, and then they had to push me back in. So I said, oh, and then they had to do a C-section. So I said, oh, so I was born, tuck it. So then I called my mother and said, you know what? Let me ask a question. What did you use for money? So my mother said, we used a roll of $5 worth of dimes. These mother's rolls of dimes and nickels. Right? And I said, so I did my homework, and it turns out there wasn't enough silver in a $5 a dime to be equivalent of Chamisha Slayim B'Shalach Shekel HaKadosh. So we were faced with a situation of who lived those and who lived those. Now the din is that who lived those and who lived those, we pass in who kodeh. But my wife said, no, I'm not doing that. So we had the pidyon HaBen one night, and then the next day I went to the Kohen, who actually had been put to Pada Abi, and he did a pidyon HaBen for me, and that was it. So I'm the last person. I'm really not one of these academic skeptics in terms of the historical record, because even if it's not exactly what the historians say, it's a lot more it's got its own point to make and so on. In any event, so I think so. It's very, but why not? I mean, that the Samaritans were constantly lobbying against the Jews in Jerusalem. We know that from Ezra and Nehemiah. That the Samaritans, there's not a lot of good blood between us to this day, is also true. I mean, I discovered this when I was in Hargrizim last Cholamoy Tzukis. So is it possible? Yeah, it's certainly possible. Could I have a dream? Yeah, why not? I mean, I have no problem with that. That Chazal would call him Alexander the Great, and meant whoever the king was, fine, he represents the king, whatever the case might be. There's a scene, in fact, in Masada, in the miniseries, which I managed to torment down not long ago, in which a legate comes to Flavius Silva, and he takes the baton that Flavius Silva had given him, and says, now there is no longer one of this person is, now there is only Vespasian Caesar. That's how people saw things, you know, conceptually, so I have no problem with that. Anyways, the question is, who was this Shimon HaTzadik? It's a matter of contention. Yeshomrim v'Yeshomrim. The point is, he was at the end of the object of the Gdola. Interestingly, the Malbim, who certainly had a historical sense, makes the observation. He says it's interesting. He says this is not his personal. Why do we have to know he was the Mishael Reansay next to the Gdola? Why is that interesting? Why is that important to me? It's identification. But the Malbim says no. Who kibel from Anshei Knesset Hagdola? What do I have to know that he was Mishare Anshei Knesset Hagdola? What does that tell me? So the Malbim zoom by implication in his parish on Ezra zooms into this. He sort of focuses and he says, no, he was Anshei. He had his obligation not just to pass on the Masorah. His obligation was he wanted to sum up the activity of Anshei Knesset Hagdola because he knew he was living in a transitional age. That's what he says. The Malbim says, "Ki b'mei Knesset Hagdola nitbatzru shlosha amudim eila al yedei shlosha anashim mesuyamim." He says, "When the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, they saw their function as fortifying three fundamental pillars of Jewish life, of reconstituted Jewish life in the land of Israel. Al Yedei Zerubbabel, who was the king, Yehoshua, who was the Kohen Gadol, Zerubbabel and Yehoshua, Kohen Gadol, they built the Beit HaMikdash and they established Avodah. And then came Ezra, who established the Torah, who brought the Torah back, and Nehemiah, who built Chomot Ha'ir. First comes Avoda, Torah, and Gemilut Chasadim. You will come back to that.
Okay.
So there were three fundamental. The three founding fathers, as it were, of the Second Commonwealth, they represented each one of these fundamental elements of the Second Temple. Culture, second century religious culture of the activity of that Shekhinah Gdola, and that's why Shimon HaTzadik, he didn't come just to say this is what I think, but rather I am now summing up what we are now passing on. This is the sum total of everything that we're passing on, which I thought was a really, really, really neat. A really neat sort of nuance. Now the question, your question is correct. Now, according to the Malbim, the order should be different. It should be Torah, Avodah, Ala Torah, Ala Avodah, Ala Gemilah. So number one, the first thing, when I saw this, it hit me. There are actually other Mephoshim say something similar. What struck me was something else. The historians like to point out, or like to argue, that until the destruction of the temple, Avodah was certainly more important than Torah, and the Torah came to take the place of Avodah. It was not as central. It was pushed by Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, by the Prushim, as sort of like a substitute. Now, this is a very, very old Mishnah. The statement certainly predates the Chorban. So I see in this formulation a very clear refutation of that argument. Torah is at the center of things from the very, very beginning. Nevertheless, I will say this, and this pops up in the Mephoshim as well. I won't go into all of them right now, but it's an important thing to keep in mind. There is a fundamental tension in Judaism down to this day as to what is more important. Okay, that the fact that Libriyot. The fact that Torah comes first in the words of Shimon HaTzadik, fine. Torah comes first. We'll see in a second why Torah comes first. All the Mefarshim will say because the world depends on Torah. Okay, we'll come to that. But nevertheless, there is a fundamental tension down through the ages. What is more important? Is Torah more important, or is Tefillah more important? Let's take Avoda in the broader sense. In other words, divine service more important, or is Tefillah more important, or is Torah more important? So that's, or spirituality. So that actually comes down to be a very important, among Chazal you have these arguments. So for example, you have cases of a Moroyim where the Gemara says that so-and-so didn't daven a month, 2 months, 6 months. Why? Because he's constantly learning and he's involved with learning, so he wasn't going to stop his learning to be able to daven. Except for Kriyat Shema. Kriyat Shema is a different story. We'll maybe on another occasion, because that's Kabbalah Zol Mechus Shemayim. Okay. On the other hand, you have a statement attributed to Rabbi Yochanan. It says, V'alavai shit palel adam kol yom kolo. Alavai person should daven all day long. Which means what? If that's the optimal, then it's interesting in that regard. Then when we learn, so obviously there is a superiority to. There's a superior statement. There's something superior to be made about with regard to the prayer superior. In fact, of all places, a student of mine came up with this. I argue this in my book about Ashkenaz before the Bali Tosfos. We'll come back to that in a minute. There's a statement in Akdamos. Now, Akdamos that we say on Shavuos before Kriyas HaTorah was written before the Bali HaTosfos. It reflects the earliest sensitivities of Ashkenazic Jewry, and there's a line here which is absolutely stunning, which I never noticed, and my student, Rabbi Matanya ben Gedalia, who is also, by the way, a phenomenal cipher and very reasonable. So if you ever need Sophras, he's really incredible. Pointed this out to me, and it was really very, my eyes bugged out when I first saw it. There's a line that goes as follows. Okay, he says Tzvi b'chamid v'ranig dil on b'la'uta. He desired and he wanted us Jews to work hard in learning Torah. Tzlutahon b'chein mekabel v'hanya ba'uta. In order that their prayers should be accepted, the implication being that you learn in order to facilitate prayer. And not the other way around. It's a very striking thing. So you have a certain tension. What is, you know, what's on a higher level? The if you consider, for example, the fact that in fact, one of the, what a beautiful word the Rav used to once mentioned. He says, why is it? He says it's traditional for us to end Shabbos morning davening. We don't do it. So we finish Shabbos morning davening with the Don Olam. And in the morning, at night, to sing Yigdal. So, what's it does? It's fakert. Because Adon Olam, you're supposed to say at the end of Kriyashma. If you have patience to say the whole Kriyashma Lamita, the last thing you do is you say Adon Olam. Why? It's a nighttime prayer. Yigdal is in the morning. It's a Shosha Asari Karim. It's Shachris. So, why the flip? So the Rav said, because really, it's trying to indicate the fact that Rabbi Yochanan is right. That Alavaisha Yipalel Adam Kol Yom Kulo. So what do you do? So symbolically, you start Ma'ariv at the end of Shachar. You start Shachar at the end of Ma'ariv. Now I don't know if he meant it seriously, but the truth of the matter is, I once used it to very good effect. I was still rabbinating in Riverdale, people make a tremendous amount of noise after Aleinu, after Anim's Miros, actually. And they start putting away the Talasim and this and that and the other thing. So I got up and I told Mishol Vort. I said, you see from this that Adon Olam is an integral part of the davening, and you shouldn't put away the Talasim. It worked once. It worked once.
Rabbi Levine in Philadelphia said, you know, Adon Olam is not background music.
Okay, but in any event, but to the Rabbi, I'll be din, I said, that was the point. In any event, so you have this tension here. On the other hand, and this is something that Rav says in Lonely Man of Faith, is that there's another reason why avoda would be put forth first. I'm sorry, you can actually cut it both ways. Because I mentioned a few weeks ago about the crisis that Anshei Knesset Dola had to face. We talked about the cessation of prophecy. Okay, so there were two things involved in that. Number one, the Rav says this in Lonely Man of Faith. He points out, look it. Starting with Avraham Avinu, okay. Prayer and prophecy create a dialogue. Prophecy is what God has to say to you. Prayer is what we have to say back to God. The two go together. With the cessation of prophecy, there's no more what God has to say to you. The fear was that in fact, that's it, finished. Hester Ponim. We have nothing. It took tremendous amount. I mean, I mentioned it in passing as a sort of like, well, they set up the tefillah system, right? But it's more than that. They said no. This at the mangina hazoti afshar lahafsik. Basically, we still believe it's possible to communicate. We will speak, even though we don't know. We think God's listening, but He's not responding. So then the question is, ah. So very nice. So therefore, what comes first? Okay, is it avoda comes first because that's what we have remaining of the dialogue, or Torah comes first because Torah is the remaining record of what the earlier parts of the dialogue were? I mean, so that's also conceptually part of the issue. There is finally one more part of this sort of like avoda Torah tension that deserves mentioning. From the time the Bali Tosfos was on, at least, there is a fundamental distinction between Ashkenazim and Sephardim on this issue. Sephardim, their position is that one studies, at least Gemara, things like that, to know the halacha, period. That's what it's for. At Ma Diber Hashem, at Maaseh Asher Yasun, goodbye. Therefore, anything which is theoretical and not of practical import is rejected. So look at the Rift. What did the Rift do? The Rift's opinion was if a position is suggested and not accepted, so it's finished. So he threw it all out and says, I'm gonna summarize it all up. I'll say what the major machlokas is, and the answer is goodbye. Why? Because I need the bottom line. That's what you learn Torah to know what the halacha is. What do you do with the other time? The other time has to be spent on spirituality, whether it's philosophy, whether it's Kabbalah, whether it's Chumash, whatever he's going to do. But the soul deserves its moment. The Ashkenazi position, certainly from the time of the Bali Tosfos was on, is exactly the opposite. No. Tefillah is okay, but if you really want to know, everything is included in the act of learning halacha, in the act of learning Gemara. So, and in fact, it's well known, for example, I don't know what goes on in Black Hat Yeshivas today, but in Volozhin, for example, tefillah, they daven. I mean, all right, daven. It didn't take that long. I mean, it wasn't the center of their day because Torah was more important. So the question of how come it's not avoda or Torah vavoda is very much a reflection, and in the discussions of the Meforshim on this Mishnah, it's very much a broader ongoing debate of what is on the higher level. Okay, now
we don't have any text or any Mishnah that anything in Gnez or whatever that puts a vote first to support.
No, not in terms of that. But I'm saying it. But correct. But I'm saying that according by implication, what the By implication, what the Malbim is suggesting is chronologically the first thing he had to come up with is establish worship in Torah, and Torah later, and then you have a hint at that, a little bit of hint at that. That yes, it says Allah Torah Bal Avodah Bal Kvil Chasadim, but somehow Avodah is somehow superior. You have in a statement by Rabbeinu Bachya. Now there are two Rabbeinu Bachyas. There's Bachya Be'ibin Pagoda, who was a Rav in Saragossa, who was a Dayan in the 11th century. He wrote Chovos Halvavos. He's not the one I'm talking about. The other one is Bachya Ben Asher, who was a student in the Beit Midrash of the Ramban, and who wrote the Perush on Chumash. In his commentary on Dvarim, Rabbeinu Bachya also gives you this sort of like an angle that Avodah somehow is more important. He says as follows. He quotes the Pasuk, Ki karov ilecha davar b'fichu l'vavcha la'asoto. He says there are three things. His kir b'kan shlusha dvarim. Ha-peh, the mouth. Halev v'hamaseh, your mouth, your heart, your intention, your spirituality, your inner life, and your action. Hine kol mitzvot nichlalot b'shlosha chalakim eile. All mitzvot can be subdivided into three categories. Ki yesh mitzvot liyot b'peh. There's some mitzvot depending on your mouth, on recitation. Some are depending on your heart, and some in the maseh. Val zed darshu razal, and based on that, Chazal said al shlosha dvarim ha'olam omeid. Quotes our Mishnah. Val al haTorah, val avodah, val gemilus chasadim. Al haTorah, he says, zeh b'ficha, because you talk in learning. Al avoda, zeh bil v'zehu bil vavcha. That's in your inner being. That's your inner neshama. V'zu ashod avoda shabalev, which is in our case is going to be tefila. V'al gemilas chasadim, that's chesed. That's lasoto. That's action. Interestingly, irrespective of your kavana, that's a big to do. By the way, there's a very big difference. I mean, you have to have the right kavanah when you do Gilus Chesed, when you give Tzedakah. But you have to keep in mind that there's a fundamental difference between our rabbis like to say this, but they don't realize what the contrast is. Let's leave Gemilas Chasadim out for a second, because Gemilas Chasadim has an empathic element to it, because you're Gomel Chesed. It comes right out of you, like the mother's milk. But let's look at Tzedakah for a second. Tzedakah means, you know, that's what you have to do. You know, you want to write the check, you don't write the check, you don't want to write the check, you have to write the check, and that's all. The parallel to that is the word in English and in other languages, charity. Now, charity and stucca are not the same. We translate them as if they're the equivalent, but it's not true. Charity is derived from the Latin word caritas. Caritas is derived from the word Latin, from the Greek word Latin. It's derived from the Greek word agape, which is the word that appears in the New Testament, and that's what Jesus is always saying. You have to have agape. You always have to have love, and that's translated as love. Okay, agape it's love. But it means that all actions by which you do for other people have to be motivated by agape. Okay, now therefore, there is no demand of tzedakah. It's just if you feel that way. And therefore, consider how the way that the modern Christian world motivates people to give money. How do they do it? I just saw an example today. Totally, I wasn't even thinking about this at the time. I don't remember how it came up. Oh, I know. Gene Stapleton died yesterday. So I was watching on YouTube. I took a break from work, so I was doing a retrospective on her life. So on the side of the suggested videos on YouTube, there's a whole bunch of other people died. You know, we see what they said when these people died. So I took a look, and the first thing that popped up on the list, I don't know why, was a retrospective on Dean Martin. And I happen to like, since I am aficionado of Italian and Italian culture, and happens to be that Dean Martin's rendition of Volare happens to be one of my favorites. So I took a look at this thing. And of course, you go from Dean Martin. You can't. If you admit you have Dean Martin, you say what? Jerry Lewis. Jerry Lewis means what? Well, I mean, it's no. Telethon. What was the? How did the telethons work? The telethons work by you bring out Mishtugedach. You bring out a bunch of crippled kids on the thing, in wheelchairs, and they're half dead, and there's Jerry's kids, and looks like a bunch of Rachmanises. And what's the idea? You put them out in front of everybody. Everybody feels bad for them, and you give money. Okay. Now, all right, fine. Jerry Lewis is Kilu Jewish. Okay, fine. But this is not Jerry Lewis who came up with this. This is a classic Protestant Christian idea. When the people, I think it's 400 in the Blue Book. When the fancy, you know, the WASPs and the high society in New York used to have these benefits for the poor, you know, benighted Irish kids in Hell's Kitchen and Dorton in upper and in Yorkville and all this other stuff. What they used to do, they used to have these enormously dazzling soirees, and they'd invite a couple of poor kids who they would be there, and they'd be in rags, and you'd see them, and you'd feel bad, and you'd give them money. What's the point? You can't justify, you know, alms unless you feel badly. And whereas our says, yes, we have it, said their involvement and give me this chesed, but at the end of the day, the requirement to be gomel chesed, or the requirement to give tzedakah, it may be enhanced by identification. Sometimes we're actually annoyed by it, this is one shnorer, I haven't seen him in a while actually. Some of these shnorers outside of Tachlan Merkazit, this is one guy takes his shoes off to make a point that he doesn't have shoes. He has shoes, but you know, to get you to give. But the point is whether it is or not. Or as my mother-in-law likes to point out, that if a Jew, that's the halacha, that if a Jew puts out his hand, you have to put money. That doesn't mean you have to give him a lot of money. I mean, I remember before when the Tachanah Merkazit was where it is now, but was the previous Tachanah Merkazit, when you walked in, on the right hand side was a guy who was selling newspapers, and there was this one guy, Schnorrer, who was always there. And
the guy selling newspapers had one hand.
No, that was on the left hand side. There was a guy on the left hand side. He was the guy with the one hand, the one arm, and then the opposite was another guy who had all of his newspapers laid out. And there was a guy in the middle who was always sitting in a box, and he was always collecting. So I remember once I came in, I went to buy paper, and the guy didn't have change. So he said, whatever the guy's name is, Chaim, you have change? It's the schnorrer. So it pulls out a one. I mean, man, this was like, so he peels off whatever it was. Probably 10 shekel notes at the time, right? He's peeling off, God almighty, look at this. Bucht of money. So it's not always, but that's what I learned. That's what I learned that lesson really fast.
You mean you wouldn't give it to Karen Kayem if they gave $500,000?
That's unbelievable. That is unbelievable. That is incredible. It is really...
No, can you think of worse judgment?
No, they didn't, though. Of
Jimmy Carter. They could have had Jimmy Carter.
Look, you know what? I have to tell you. We're talking about Shimon Peres. I don't know if he had stock in Tavirat or not, but there's enough, so much financial foilishtick with Shimon Peres, and who knows? You know, they made fun of Bibi, but you know, the amount of money the percentage increase in running Beit HaNasi, okay, is far and away, both in absolute terms and in percentages, far and away more than anything that's going on with Bibi's unrelenting ice cream habit. I mean, it's crazy, but I don't know. In any event, so if you take a look, so he says that's Lassos, and then he goes on and he says, so we were saying about in terms of what's more important than what, he says umin hayadua. He says it's well known. Ki amitzvot hatluyot belev avoda gdola laKadosh Baruch Hu min amitzvot hatluyot badibur. God values mitzvahs that are based on your heart over those that are through speech. Now he just finished telling you that learning is through speech, and avoda and tefillah is through your heart. So you don't have to be a genius to put two and two together. So you have, this is an ongoing struggle, tension within the Masorah. Okay, so that is that's the next point. Ala Torah v'al avoda v'al gemilas chasadim. So here, everybody comes up with the Bart Nura says it, then everybody else says it also. Hu ayom ala Torah says the Bart Nura. He quotes the Gemara, famous Gemara. Why is it Yamaya? He says Shelmole lo kiblu Yisrael satorah lo nivru shemayim v'aretz. The whole world was predicated upon the idea that the Jews would accept the Torah, which ultimately ends up morphing into the idea that the primordial, whatever this means, that the primordial Torah is the arc, is the blueprint of creation, and that Yom HaShishi, why Yom HaShishi? Because all of creation was contingent upon the sixth of Sivan when the Jews accepted the Torah. He actually cites a pasuk. It's easier to say. He cites a pasuk in Yirmiyah, which is quoted by the Gemara. In Lo Brisi Yamam V'Laila Chukos Shemayim V'Aretz Lo Samti, that if it weren't for the fact of the bris, then God would not have created the world. I don't understand what the significance of that statement is. It's not just that. The idea that the world is predicated on Torah and the Torah embodies the fundamental rules of justice and righteousness and propriety, and justice, of course, is by definition everything is balanced and everything is in order and so on and so forth. And if you violate that order, the world will return to Tohu Vavohu. So with this, you can return back to, in fact, that comment that I made in the name of the Rav about the fact that, and the Nitziv, that Bereishis Bara Elokim is the physical world. So why Vaydaber Elokim is called Dvorim HaElu? Why use Elokim? So the Rav's point was, it's the same Torah. If you violate, just as if you violate the physical rules of the world, if you jump out the window, you will die. You are defying gravity. What do we say? He's defying gravity. You can't defy gravity. If you defy gravity, you're going to go plop. The same way if you defy the moral order.
The moral order as expressed in the Torah.
The Torah is the embodiment of morality, and therefore, if you defy the moral order,
are the Goyim deeper? We're learning Nach now. The Goyim being to know the moral order that's in the Torah?
Are you asking me whether there's natural, whether there are natural ethics or not? We do not believe.
No, what I'm saying,
we do not believe in natural ethics.
The
we believe.
Nach doesn't seem to, like, we're living in Yeheskel. Yeheskel is giving judgments, giving prophecy against Tyre, giving prophecy against Egypt. Places that had nothing, and then the friends of Mitzrayim, the supporters of Mitzrayim, which have nothing to do with Eretz Israel or the Jews.
Okay.
So we've asked the question, it seems to us, that there is a natural order that they're being held to. Not the Mitzrayim, but the...
No, that is the natural order to which they're being held.
Doesn't seem to have the...
I haven't learned Yechezkel in a long time, but it seems to me, if I remember correctly, certainly based on I'm learning Yeshaya, I'm learning Yeshaya with my daughter now.
Yeah, okay.
It certainly there is nothing there that in which, and Amos, when Amos goes off on a tear against everybody in the surrounding areas in the Middle East, there is nothing there that could not be subcategorized under the Shevet Zemes. The universal rules of ethics. The question is there validity? That's a second question. If a person were to come up with those fundamental rules of morality based on philosophical speculation and not based on the fact that you heard it from Moshe Rabbeinu, we heard from the Jews, or you heard it from the Torah, does that have validity? Does that have worth? So that already is a business with the Rambam. The Rambam at the end of Hilchos Melachim makes the following statement. The Rambam says, this is the Rambam says, here it is. The Rambam says as follows. This is Perek Ches of Hilchos Melachim Halacha Yud. Moshe Rabbeinu lo inchil et haTorah v'amitzvot el Yisrael sheneamar morasha kilat Yaakov. Torah only goes to Jews. L'chol erot and u'l'chol erotze lidgayer mishar ha'umot sheneamar kachem kager. Aval mi shelo ratza en kofin oto lekabel Torah mitzvah. We are not a missionary people. V'chein tziva v'chein, but in the precise, when the Rambam says v'chein, it means in exactly the same way. וכן ציווה משה רבנו מפי הגבורה לחוף את כל באי עולם לקבל מצוות שנצטב בבני נוח. If we have an obligation, it is to spread the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. That's their Torah. In fact, you could say that there's no such thing as Judaism. There's the worker, there's the religion of the one God, and there are levels. There's basic membership, basic membership is seven Mitzvot B'nei Noach. That's like everybody. Then you have the priests to the rest of the world, Atem Tiuli Mamlechet Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh. That's us, that's 613, not really, but whatever 60 Mitzvot we have on a regular basis. And then we have our own Kohanim, they get their own Mitzvot, right? But the point is that there is a missionary impulse or mandate, and that's the Sheva Mitzvot. V'chol mi shelo yekabel yehareg. Okay. V'mekabel otam hu nikra diger toshav b'chol makom. V'tzarich lekabel alav b'fnei shlosha chaverim. They have to accept the Sheva Mitzvot in front of the people. V'chol mekabel alav lamul v'avru alav shnei masar chodesh lomal harei as a kemina umos. If you were circumcised but you didn't finish the conversion, then you're still a guy. Yeah, finished. Okay. Then he goes and says, "Shalos, kol mekabel sheva mitzvos. If you accept the seven mitzvos, v'nizhar la'asosam, and you're careful to do them, harezim echesidim umas ha'olam. Okay, v'yesh lochel olam haba. You have a place to world to come. V'hu on one condition. V'hu shi'kabel osan v'yasa osan mivnei shetziva ben hakadosh baruch hu b'torah." But you must do it based on divine authority. You must do it because it says in the Torah that's what non-Jews are supposed to do. That's their mitzvah. That's what God Moses commanded. You do it as ectonomous ethics. It comes from the outside. It's imposed as a mitzvah, and then you're a chassid umas ha'olam. Aval im asan mipnei hechradas. But if you came to the same conclusion, based on logical argument, based on philosophy, based on whatever, autonomously, as it were, ain't a ger toshav. You do not have the status of ger toshav. Okay, you're not a ger toshav. You don't have the rights of automatic rights of residence in the because basically rights of residence here means rights of residence in Israel as a resident alien means that you accept the system. The system means the system is given by God. It's very simple. It's like anybody who becomes
that's in Eretz Israel.
That's only in Eretz Israel.
Okay, but.
Then he goes on. He says, and you are not a chassid olam, and you don't have a chelak olam haba. Now, the printed version of the Rambam says, "V'lo mechachameihem." In other words, the way that the text had it, the way it was printed for many, many generations, was that the natural or rational or philosophical ethics are they're of no value. You're neither a chassid olam nor chachmi umat ha'olam, it's nothing. Okay. Now that's the printed text. That's right here. Now in the 18th century, this came up as a topic because it troubled a very famous individual whose name was Moses Mendelssohn. It bothered him that Maimonides, his great universal thinker, really denied the value of non-revealed ethics. So he didn't know what to do. So he wrote to one of the more if Moses Mendelssohn was one of the more buttoned down, what we say, unavim kuftar, the three-piece suit types in Germany at the time. He wrote to one of the less three-piece suit people in the time. He wrote to Hamburg, to the combined town of Ahu, Altena, Hamburg, and Wandsbek, to one Rabbi Jacob Emden. And he asked him, what's the deal with this Rambam? And Emden wrote back, he says, it's a tos, it's a mistake. The real Girsa, which is actually confirmed later by the manuscripts, is he may not be among the righteous of the people of the world, rather he is from among the wise. The emperor of the world to come. Ah, it's another story. But probably not. But it has value. In other words, autonomous ethics has value.
Well,
but
God
is not as good as ectonomous revealed
ethics. Will God punish it because of autonomous ethics?
Will God punish you?
I don't think so.
But it's not as valuable. You would never as well
no,
to come.
So what is, for example, again, take Yeheskel and other medium.
No.
And we have punishments very similar to Am Yisrael being punished.
Okay, right.
For before Egypt's case, right? Mitzrayim deceived Am Yisrael, said, "We have your back," when they didn't.
Right.
"We have your back. We will support you. Don't worry about it." And they didn't mean it.
Okay. So
now, what did they do wrong? I.e., that they knew they shouldn't.
Certain there was there certain canons of decency that we expected them to keep.
From where did they come? Where did they come from?
So that's an interesting question. So how would the Rambam square that?
Correct. That was our question. Hmm.
The conclusion would be, L'chaira, that in fact, that whereas you may not be, you have granted the status of Ger Toshav and not like say Olam Haba, that there is certain amounts of universal world of the rules of decency you are expected to.
From where did they come, and how would they know it? I mean, from a justice point of view, God is just. So now.
Yes, when did He warn them?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a good question.
You need to. I mean, you need to have it if you're going to have this God of justice.
Yeah, it's full of such the Yecheskel and Yirmiyahu and
right. So
it's full of such examples.
Look, so the truth of the matter is that Maimonides himself was of the opinion that the world started monotheistically. So one could argue perhaps that there was a residual kind of sense of morality that should have been maintained. One could argue that there were certain things that were so obvious that they might as well have been said. What is it? What did Chazal say? That there were certain mitzvahs that had they not been given,
yeah,
they would have been given. So what, like Kibbutz of Eim and Gezel and Retzach and stuff. Certain things are just so self-evidently true. In fact, you have cases. By the way, Alpi did like that. You have cases where, for example, I don't. I mean, it happens to be for different. There's something else I'm learning, so it pops into my head at the moment. The question. There is a discussion in the discussion in the Gemara about the affecting a transaction with money. Okay. Affecting a transaction with money. So the question is, what function does the money serve? So if the money serves as a consideration, when by which a change in status is affected, so there you have a pasuk which establishes that fact. For example, when a couple gets married, you're not buying. One of the more radical feminists that I've been in contact with recently said, "Well, we have to get rid of this whole thing of kinyan and kedushin." It's a total misunderstanding about what happens in kedushin. It's a change in status which is affected through a consideration. It's got nothing to do with the value of a person. On the contrary, the Rav used to point out that by definition, people have no monetary value. That's why the Gemara has trouble figuring out, well, how do you estimate damages? And how do you, because you have to go pretend that they're a slave. Or the whole point at the end of Vayikra, that the Torah pegs these values on people, because there's no other way but sort of set values of what a person is worth when they say, "I'm 40 years old and I put my Erech on the line." It's an artificial thing, because a person has no, in Damim Levin Chorin. So in any case, that's one type. The other time, there's a reason why I'm going here. There's another machlokus as to whether maus konos v'atorah, whether in all other transactions, when you give money for the worth of a cup or a cookie or whatever it is, whether that works. And Rabbi Yochanan says, and it says you don't need any proof. Svarihi, it's logical. And as a result, I mean, and what does that mean? So Yosef Engel, others, he's not the only one, says, no, when something is so self-evident that it's true, that it's so obviously logical, then that's been HaTorah. That's been HaTorah. Interesting possibilities with Yosef Engel actually in Brachas makes an interesting observation. Something I've always played with. It's one of these. I raised this with a friend of mine who is now a very famous Rosh Hashiva, and at the time I was young. I said the idea that brachas might be doraisa, certain brachas might be then doraisa, and he says, "It's stupid. Don't talk about blah blah blah." Rabbi Svegel says exactly that. He says on the Gemara in brachas and Ketan Mevarchim, they talk to how do you so the Gemara tries to figure out where do you derive brachas from? It's from this and from that and this and that. El, so the maskana is Ella Svarei. It's logical. So Rabbi Yisrael Feigl says, I don't understand. We pasken most konas midvar Torah based on svarta din d'oraisa. So l'chayra brachas din d'oraisa. So how can it be the rabbanon? I mean, it raises all kinds of interesting questions. But the point is, if something is so self-evidently true,
but it's not based on the Sheva Mitzvahs that they know of.
Right, so then that's the question. That's an interesting question. That's a question that would have to be discussed. But if a person comes up, so that's probably the Rambam over here. Unless you say God is the source of all truth, and therefore if something is so evidently logical, then therefore it's as if it's revealed. Right, so that's the question. So that's an interesting question we have to be discussed.
So that's
yes.
What we run across.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I don't know. All right, so we'll finish this mission the next week, Mr. Shekhar.